All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum
freedom. Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Merry Christmas and welcome to the Read Rothbard Merry Christmas special. This is Daniel, and with me is Robert, who is feeling merry, but a little queasy. How you doing?
Yeah, just not so special. Feeling less special than normal. Last night was the it was a couple hours ago actually, the annual Christmas party that was really fun. But I'm not a drinker, and I did drink last night. So I mean, I do drink, but not on a regular basis. And so then when you do it, so anyway, I am laying in bed with my eyes closed. And trying to hold real still.
Well, 'twas the hangover before Christmas. That's beautiful.
Yeah. You got to remind yourself what it's like to remind yourself why you don't do this very often.
Yeah, indeed. I recall the last time I was super drunk, I required darkness and silence for a couple of days. It was no fun.
Yeah, it's really horrible. It's alcohol's a hell of a drug.
Well, I do appreciate
you still coming on.
We're supposed
to be talking about Charlie Dickens? Is that what we're doing today?
Yeah, Chuck Dickens. Christmas
yeah,
Carol.
Chuck. That's right. Do you want to do some housekeeping beforehand, or is this the special, right, so we don't necessarily have to do that stuff?
No, not a whole lot of housekeeping. I mean, we've done 30-some-odd shows now, and we're doing this special. I think this is, our fourth special now. And speaking of specials, Tom Woods is having the Liberty Classroom special. Going on now, still through December 30th. So what you got to do is tomorrow when you open your stockings and gifts and get that card from Grandma with $12 in it, take those dollars, those smackers together, and use them to get yourself a little something called the Tom Woods Liberty Classroom. Get the master membership. We will also kick in a one-year readitfor.me membership, and we also have a one-month trial, so we'll start that first, and you'll effectively get 13 months for $0. As a bonus to getting the Liberty Classroom at readrothbard.com/libertyclassroom. How's that for housekeeping?
Well done. Well said. Do this.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about Charlie Dickens and the Christmas Carol. I don't want to say spoilers because probably everyone has heard this story. It's a very, it's a holiday time tradition. I know when I was a kid, I saw the Disney version, and we, I think, learned about it in school. We saw plays on TV. There's probably, dozens and dozens of iterations of this in film and television. So it's a well-known thing, and I never really gave it much thought prior to, recently. Like, what is the meaning behind it all? What do you think?
Well, yeah, like you said, it's ubiquitous in the culture. You can't grow up and really be unfamiliar with it. I mean, if you're an English speaker, somewhere in the world you've been exposed to this. And we can get into why Dickens wrote it. But in the end, it smacks to me as a big old fat anti-capitalist message, saying that this businessman Scrooge is just this cold, heartless guy. And if he actually had a heart, he would, pay people more, in brackets, more than they're worth. But that he would actually, for some reason, pay for Tiny Tim's, surgery or whatever, his operation, or give his... give Cratchit, is it Cratchit right? Yeah, Cratchit a day off without pay. But the reverse isn't the same, right? So he's perfectly fine with taking a day off pay, but is he perfectly fine with working a day for no pay? So I don't. It's an unequal relationship there. But then the Marxists will say that it's already an unequal relationship because Scrooge has the power in the relationship and he's actually exploiting Cratchit and all this. But it's a voluntary relationship. Cratchit works there voluntarily. He prefers to work for Scrooge, or else he wouldn't work there. He'd work somewhere else. It's not Scrooge's fault that Cratchit has a big family to support. Those are all choices that Cratchit made. So to say that, well, if Scrooge just had a heart, he cared about people and whatever, that he would do all this, it's saying that Scrooge is somehow responsible for Cratchit's decisions in life. And it's also along the lines of this theme that capitalists don't care about people. They just care about money. Well, how do you get money? You get money by serving your fellow man, by creating objects that people desire, that improve their lives. So capitalism serves the poor and other humanity greater than anything else. I mean, you go into a store, everything in that store was created by some capitalist. It was just looking to make a profit. Not because they care about your kid, not because they care about the poor or whatever, but yet those objects that surround you right now, those man-made objects that you're talking on your phone, you're living in a house, you're driving a car, all those things were made by capitalists looking to make a buck. And you don't necessarily have to have a heart to serve humanity, I guess is my point.
Well, it's usually the people who have a heart that are the do-gooders trying to go out and forcibly make others do their bidding.
Right. Even though in the story, nobody's necessarily forcing Scrooge. They're trying to convince Scrooge that it would be better for him to be more generous or what have you.
Well, the three spirits are basically threatening him with an eternal damnation, wearing the chains of his own greed. Like, that's what Marley tells him, is like, your chains will be heavier than mine. Three spirits will visit you, ghost, Christmas past, present, and future.
So yeah, I suppose you're right.
A bit of a threat.
So, yeah, that they're threatening him with some future badness. You know, some kind of threat that it'll be happening bad to him in the future if he doesn't change his ways now. But all the ghosts miss the point that all his customers are well served, or else he wouldn't be such a successful businessman.
Yeah, and I don't know, you have a copy. You told me the other day that you woke up looking out the window and there was snow coming down, and you look to your left and there's this copy of Christmas Carol to your left, just randomly there from something like 30 years ago, right? Or 20 years ago?
30? Yeah, it was given to me by my grandmother in like 1984, and it was just sitting next to the bed. So I picked it up and I started reading it a little bit. It was just funny to look at the old-timey language.
Yeah, so speaking of that, I don't know if you've read through the whole thing or not, but I wonder how much different it is from the Disney version, because that's the level of discourse I'm going to be bringing to the conversation, is the Scrooge McDuck version, and that's going to be why the artwork looks the way it does for this episode. But he makes several points in the Disney version. He says, oh, Marley robbed from the widows and swindled the poor, or he would charge his customers 80% interest compounded daily. Or he was so miserly that he wouldn't even let Cratchit use a lump of coal to heat up the ink that he used to do his work because the ink was frozen. I mean, do you think that level of demonization of this man is in the original work, or do you think that Disney upped their game a bit, like amplified that shit?
Well, as Disney is wont to do, they have a habit of taking a story and Disneyfying it. Usually they play it down. Usually they'll take a story with a whole lot of blood and violence and make it more palatable for like a G-rated audience. I'm not sure if what you're saying is true, but we could play it up. I mean, we could answer it as if it were. We don't necessarily need to be responding to the original work. We could be responding to the Disney version, which would be fine. Even if those things are true, Cratchit still prefers to work for Scrooge. There's no gun to Cratchit's head saying that he has to work there. He can take his labor elsewhere if he finds a better deal. And if he can't, then how is that still Scrooge's fault? Scrooge is still gainfully employing the man.
Well, and by default,
values Cratchit's labor.
Yeah, by default, giving him the best deal available to him, right?
Right. So if anything, he's the most generous. If Cratchit can't find a better job, then Scrooge is the most generous guy by employing this guy. If he's really that terrible, he can't get a better job elsewhere.
Yeah, and likewise for his customers, you know, like you said, he's providing a service, and if he is by any measure successful at actually making money and making profit, that means that those customers have come to him and they prefer his services to any other service.
Absolutely.
And if he weren't there providing that service, then they would by default have to choose from lesser options, lesser preferred goods and services, which means
right.
that they would
a
all be materially better off or less well off.
Right. So, yeah, they make the claim in the book that, you know, nobody's going to be sad when he dies. Well, I mean, maybe nobody's going to go to his funeral. I mean, but they're going to definitely experience a lower quality of service, of goods and services that he provides.
Yeah, assuming that no one else will fill that void or be competing with him to provide better service. I mean, that's the thing, right? In a capitalist voluntary situation, like, there would be other providers of those services constantly trying to gain advantage over what Scrooge is already doing, either by better rates or better terms, maybe even as simple as like a more cordial demeanor. You know, maybe people prefer somebody who's going to charge them a little bit more as long as they're nice versus this miserly dude who maybe gives them a better rate. You know what I mean? Like, it's like you can choose to go to two different grocery stores. One is really crappy and ugly and stinky, but the prices are low. Or you can go to the nice, sweet-smelling store where they give out the free samples, and maybe you pay a little bit more, but you still prefer to do it.
Absolutely, yeah. You're talking about catering to all levels of the market because people have different preferences. And a lot of people are willing to pay a little bit more. It's worth it to them to have a better shopping experience, to interact with a more charming individual than this old crotchety Scrooge guy. Maybe they value that a little bit more, and they're willing to pay a little bit more for a more charming or whatever kind of interactive experience. So it's not necessarily that, oh, what am I trying to say? With capitalism, you are given all these different options. You have all this bounty of options. It's like when, who was it, Yeltsin or Gorbachev, when he came over to the United States? And he went into like a random supermarket, and he was like, what is all these options? What is going on here? How is this possible? There's no way. There's no such thing as a supermarket in the Soviet Union that has any kind near the choices and the options available to him. And he thought he had been gamed. He thought that this was like a big setup, that this grocery store had been set up this way to show him the wonders of capitalism. But he was just in some random store.
Yeah, it's like what's it, the Potemkin village, which they would have in Soviet Russia, where they would bring the journalists from the
West. Dignitaries. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just to show them how great things are.
Right, and it's all like the cardboard backing and just all fake and set up.
Yeah, it's like an old Western.
Yeah.
Hey, Robert, before we continue on, I think we have our special guest who's about to chime in. It's going to be one of the folks who runs the Scottish Liberty podcast. Is that what it's called? We're going to have to get
know best. In fact, actually, he would know best.
Yeah, he would know best, and he should be chiming in here. But his name is Anthony, and he runs a blog called seeingnotseen.blogspot.co.uk. You can see some of his writings there. He's been fairly prolific since he started, looks like, back in November. He runs the Scottish Liberty podcast, like I was saying, and that's about as old as ours is. It's about 6 months old. He also has an emotional partner who provides a lot of color commentary, and Anthony himself is more of the intellectual. Like he told us on a pre-show call, what was that, yesterday? That he spends a lot of time studying for like the last 8-10 years. That's pretty much his only hobby, is to read about liberty and economics. So he should be chiming in just a couple minutes. And he mentioned, we're Facebook chatting right now. He said, oh, I'm sorry, I'm such an ass. I forgot, totally forgot. So he'll be calling in any moment, but, let's go back to your point about, the different, shopping environments, that are preferable to people, because there's a Murray Rothbard lecture where he mentions this about the ice cream. Like, you can get the same ice cream, like, let's call it Breyer's ice cream. Two different restaurants will buy it and sell it to you. And one of them will be, this, like, deli/diner kind of greasy spoon dive bar thing. And maybe the ice cream is a buck or two. Well, and actually, with inflation, it's probably now five or six bucks for even a dessert ice cream, right? Or you can get it at this fancy restaurant. He mentions Lutèce, which is a famous New York City restaurant, and we'll say, you know, the same exact ice cream is like going to be $15 there. And the Marxist or the leftist will look at that and go, it's the same damn ice cream. You know, how is this asshole Lutèce fancy restaurant going to charge three or four times the value of the ice cream? It doesn't make any sense. But they forget that at the fancy restaurant, you're in a beautiful environment. You've got professional wait staff. You've got probably a great view. You've had a great meal. There's great ambiance versus the dive greasy spoon that, you know, it's no longer the same thing. Even though the physical product you're purchasing is the same, the entire experience and the environment and the package and how it's delivered, how you purchase it is totally different.
Right, and the clientele in the upper-class restaurant is going to be a different people, and you may see some sort of a social status benefit from dining there. You may rub elbows with people you would like to get to know better. There's all kinds of benefits that come from eating at that establishment, obviously, or else people wouldn't do it. So, yeah, capitalism caters to all tastes, and just because it seems outrageous to you doesn't necessarily mean it's outrageous to another person. Other people may prefer it. That's the beauty of it. We're all just trying to get the most value for our money. And just because you're paying four times the price for ice cream doesn't mean you're not still getting a good value.
Yeah, you obviously preferred to have the ice cream versus the $10 or $15. Otherwise, you wouldn't have done it.
Yeah,
and it's, you know, like we're saying, it's all about choices. And the voluntary capitalist society is what provides you a plethora of choice. And to be said, they're still taking a risk in providing that ice cream at that price. I mean, maybe something happens and no one's going to buy it for $15 anymore. Then they're going to just be sitting on ice cream that's going to go bad. You know, so they're taking a risk in having it there, charging the price they are, and if they don't sell it, then, you know, they have to change what they're doing.
Absolutely, man. Life is risk. Markets are risk. Being an entrepreneur involves a great deal of risk. And, I don't think that really gets super appreciated, especially among the lefties and the cults and the Marxists. They see it as exploitation to be like the owner and actually not doing any work, quote unquote, when in reality they're taking a much greater risk than the worker who's getting paid immediately. The time sink, the time investment, the payoff for the owner is much greater. And there's no real guarantee there.
Yeah, and it's over an extended time horizon, because the structure of production is, I mean, they've got to invest in getting the space and building out a restaurant and hiring and training the staff and getting all the goods and, you know, the food that it's going to be prepared. I mean, there's so much that goes into it that they certainly wouldn't be doing it unless there was some potential for them to make a return on that.
Right, but it's still a big investment, and it's all speculation, right? I mean, it's a big risk. There's no guarantee that it's all going to pay off. And in fact, most businesses close because it takes a fair amount of time to build up a clientele list to make a restaurant profitable. To say that the owner, you know, isn't doing a lot of work or isn't there's exploiting somehow its workers or isn't providing value himself is unappreciative. And what's actually at work here.
Yeah, my kids have taken an interest in learning how things are made. So we go on YouTube and we look at how, you know, like, say, pencils are manufactured. So not even the, you know, Leonard Reed iPencil essay where all the components are from various different areas of the world and people, millions of interconnected people are working in their own self-interest to provide the raw materials for these things, and they come together through the magic of the market. No, this is like once those materials are brought to a facility and manufactured, you see the machinery that goes into this. I mean, this is like huge, like Costco-sized facility, right? With huge equipment, costs hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars, and it's all very, very specialized. So many moving parts and custom engineered solutions to make it more efficient. And for the Marxists to say that they are going to then seize the means of production, I mean, do they think that shit just falls out of the sky? You know, this totally customized machine that costs, you know, millions of dollars to set up this plant, easily millions of dollars. They're just going to take it?
Yep. And then there's going to be no innovation because there's no incentive to innovate after that. So it's just going to be set at that level forever until a capitalist comes back. But yeah, that's what they're going to do. They're going to seize it because, you know, you don't own property, right? You didn't work for that or something. You didn't build that. You didn't do it yourself. Even if you did do it yourself, you still don't own it because property doesn't exist, apparently. Or I guess there's personal property and private property. But what the distinction is nebulous at best.
Yep, I can certainly use lots of different items in both capacities. So,
right. What's the distinction between means of production and personal property? Try to get a definition out of anybody. It's impossible. Your toothbrush, maybe. Who knows?
Well, in your arguments last night with some folks, wasn't there some contention about whether they actually owned themselves or not?
Yeah, I was speaking with some socialists last night, and actually the one guy was believed that he was himself and that he ultimately was the ultimate decider about what happens to himself unless somebody stronger came along and forced him to do a thing. I'm not sure if he made the distinction on whether it was moral or not. We didn't really get into that too much. It would have been nice. It would actually be fun to have him on. I'd be fascinated to find out what he actually believes about that. But yeah, it doesn't make sense. If you own yourself, then you need to have some property. I mean, with which to live, to survive. If you actually don't have anything, how can you? And that ties in with the Scrooge argument, in that, you know, are you more apt to be generous when you have nothing or when you have a great deal, as capitalism allows? Capitalism is the golden goose, and to kill it and turn to socialism, I think you're going to end up with a far less generous society. And what is altruism anyway if it's at the point of a gun? I wouldn't call it altruism. And I just sat up, and that was a mistake. Oh.
And it was the hangover before Christmas. Man, sorry you're going through that experience. It sounds rough.
Yeah, and I'm supposed to go on a drive today. It's not going to be good. I should be fine in a couple hours. I just need to get some sleep. I party went to like 3 a.m., and I had sobered up enough. So I drove home, and I was fine. But I should have drank more water. Not good.
This is where the Reed Rothbard podcast Christmas, Merry Christmas special gets real, people.
Yeah, I'll try not to vomit as we're recording. I think it would just be dry heaving at any point. Anyway, I didn't like drink any or eat any food.
Oh, that's the other half of the equation there, bud.
Yeah, well, I don't believe in eating when it's dark out. I mean, I do it sometimes, but it's generally not a good idea. You really just don't need all those calories right before you go to sleep. This is a bad idea. In fact, I'm getting more towards the one meal a day thing, which apparently there's a bunch of scientific evidence to support. And
97% of scientists agree that might be better for you?
You're not going to get me to argue like Steph or a statist here, buddy, but there is some evidence to support that in order to enter the state of ketosis, which is where your body starts eating fat to provide energy, you first need to drain your liver of glucose, and it takes a certain amount of time for your liver to do that. So after you've digested your food, it takes like 12 or 14 hours or something like that, or 16 hours, in order for your liver to completely drain of glucose. And so you're not going to really burn fat until you hit that point. There may be other ways to induce ketosis, but this is the way I'm talking about it as far as dieting-wise.
The previous statement was not medical advice and is not approved by the FDA. Reed Rothbard and ReedRothbard.com is in no way endorsing this type of diet, and we are not medical doctors. At your own risk. Blah, blah, blah. Legal, legal. Crap, crap.
Yeah, good. Well said, Daniel. Thank you for that legal cover. Yeah, I'm not an expert. I'm just a guy talking about a thing. Use at your own risk, everything I say. But yeah, I'm getting kind of into that. It's been interesting. Because, you know, as you get older, your metabolism slows down anyway. And I feel like, you know, I only really need to eat once a day. It's fine.
So,
my old man's been doing it for like 30 years. And then I finally started doing it this past year. And it's actually working out just fine.
So how do you handle the latitude? Because in the summer, of course, where we are, there's like 16 or 17 hours of daylight. And then in the winter, there's only seven hours of daylight or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a pretty wide swing just based on the time of year.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I do it more of a time thing. I mean, if it's like 10 o'clock at night in the summertime and it's still bright out, you know, I'm not eating. I usually have one meal, and this is totally about libertarianism people.
We will tie it in.
Two or three o'clock. You know, I think Scrooge only eat one meal a day. I think that's how we're going to tie that in. It's around 2-3 o'clock at the latest usually. And then that's good for me for the day. I might have like some snacks later on, but no real meals. I don't know. What do you do? Are you still like eating like three squares?
Yeah, we're on that family plan where we sit down, we have meals together three times a day. Mm-hmm. And I think for the
that's
kids,
right.
Yeah, they got to keep eating. They're fueling their growth and all of those things. I mean, as nutrition has improved over the years, as poverty has been alleviated by capitalism, more and more nutrition has led to healthier people that are more resistant to disease. We get taller, stronger, faster, smarter over generations, and it's all thanks to capitalism. So that's how we tie this all together, buddy.
Yeah, and I was talking last night with the Marxist, and I was trying to make the point that poverty, you're always going to have poverty because poverty is just a percentage. It's always a sliding scale. It's just, you know, the people under the, you know, 20% or the 15% lowest incomes. It's not necessarily a standard of living. I was trying to make the point that, you know, the average poor person today lives better than the kings of old. If people today have things kings of old would kill for, would never even dream or imagine possible. The fact that we fly through the air in metal tubes, the fact that we drive around in motorized vehicles, that we have all of human knowledge at our fingertips at any given time. And I'm an incredibly poor person, so I know what I'm talking about. I still have an incredibly high standard of living compared to people back in the day that couldn't even imagine the far-flung, space-tastic future that I'm living in.
Yeah, you know, it's really a function of
capitalism.
It's a function of how great capitalism is that people have time to sit around and bitch about it on their iPhones.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and that sort of makes me think of Charlie Dickens. He had some measure of success in his lifetime writing books, so he wasn't necessarily scrounging around, you know, hand to mouth, trying to survive day to day. I mean, his childhood was a little bit rougher. I think in the Wikipedia article it says that when he was a young child, his father had to go to prison for several months, and he was put into a boarding house and had to work in a factory, and that sort of colored his view on capitalism or the factory lifestyle. And of course, you know, it probably wasn't very pleasant, but either was starvation. You know, there was an explosion of population in a very short period of time, you know, just a couple hundred years, whereas the previous 1,000 years, the growth in the population was, say, you know, 1% per year or decade. And then all of a sudden the agricultural revolution happens, new farming techniques come into play that increase crop yields, the enclosure movement happens. So now these common fields that people could only use for part of the year were now privately owned and could be cultivated to their best use. And so the quantity and abundance of food increased dramatically. At the same time, the requirements of the number of people working in those fields was reduced, and you had an exploding population. So all of these factors led to, you know, just the ability to be able to live and survive and not starve led to a huge dramatic growth in population, and they all had to go do something, go somewhere, you know. They didn't have to work in the fields anymore, so they migrated towards the cities. And then there was this abundance of labor available, and entrepreneurs at the time were, people were in what's the system that was called, and you're going to like this, Robert, the putting out system. And the putting out system was people who worked in their own homes, had their own equipment, and they fashioned goods from start to finish. And as you can imagine, you know, you can make some pretty high quality luxury type goods this way, but they're going to be expensive. They're going to be in short supply, and only a few people are going to be able to get those goods because one person working front to end of, you know, making shoes or making a suit or making a hat can only make so many. And I think maybe this is where some of the Marxist ideas of owning the means of production comes from, because at that time, these people had to actually own that equipment and have it all in their own house. And as you can imagine, that would also be a very expensive proposition. And so since most people were poor, couldn't afford to have their own equipment, they had to do other things, right? And so maybe that's where some of this means of production idea comes from. I'm just kind of rambling on here.
No, you're doing fine. I was going to add just a few things, a few thoughts to just back up what you're saying. That idea of a specialized person making a custom thing. And, of course, yeah, you're going to get a much more unique, maybe custom, maybe higher quality item, but you're also going to have to pay for it. I mean, that's true if you just today with all kinds of high-end goods, but also especially things like Etsy, which is a marketplace, online marketplace for homemade goods where people will knit a hat. And you're talking about buying the labor of this one artisan in the United States, buying this completely custom hat that nobody else is going to have. So it's very exclusive. It's probably going to be well-made, but each individual is going to be different, I'm sure. And you can judge that by their reviews and whatnot. So, yeah, I don't have a point to make about that.
That's good.
The means of production. But we've
almost come full circle on that, because now we're back to that Marxist paradise where now people can have equipment in their home and there's a marketplace for them to sell their goods. So all these lefties should be happy, right? But of course, now they're pissed off that people are working at home, being exploited in their own home.
Well, it doesn't take much to piss off a lefty. I mean, people get pissed off about Uber, a service that hadn't existed up until just like a few years ago. And then all of a sudden it becomes a right that they have to be considered a customer, an employee and have all these other benefits. You know, how dare they just provide a service? Anyway,
yeah,
going back to
years before, their car was just sitting there.
Yeah, it was just sitting there. And they weren't a taxi driver. They weren't, you know, using it to get extra cash. They're just driving around anyway or whatever they were doing. Going way back now to your talking about the Industrial Revolution and the explosion of food, that is very true in not just in humankind, but in the animal world where mothers will oftentimes, in times of abundance, give birth to more and more children. They will go into heat more frequently when there is a great deal of food around. You see this in primates and in ungulates. All sorts of animals do this, and probably all of them. But off the top of my head, those are the first two examples that come to mind, where when you go through lean times, the women, just the females just won't go into heat because there's just no food around. It's really a function of biology, and it's a response to abundance. And so, in my view, the Industrial Revolution really created the abundance which allowed for the population to explode.
Right, yeah, because the mechanization and industrialization is like making of factories, and sure, there were some appalling conditions in there, but of course they were preferable to the alternatives, otherwise they wouldn't have done it. But
right.
It's sort of the opposite of this putting out system, because now you had entrepreneurs saying, hey, I can get larger equipment, bring it all together, get it powered, and bring in labor to work on this stuff, and they'll specialize in just one or two components of the process, you know, of the assembly line process, using automated equipment or powered equipment, you know, water wheel, steam, whatever, and create a huge increase in the supply of the goods. So now your average Joe and Jane will be able to have something that was once only available to a very rich few, you know?
Right. Like, and a really good example of that is Henry Ford, who mechanized the automobile industry, whereas before, they made cars before Ford did. He didn't invent the car, but he invented the assembly line. Well, not necessarily invented the assembly line, but really applied the assembly line to the production of automobiles, and he made them so cheaply that the average family could afford a car for the first time. Whereas before, it was, like you said, mainly only the extremely wealthy and well-off could afford vehicles like that.
Right, yeah. So it's the bringing together of all of these different components and doing it in a more efficient fashion that's going to satisfy more and more people's desires for a lower and lower price is really at the heart of voluntary exchange and capitalism. And to see, you know, through new eyes, A Christmas Carol sort of disparage that is, it's kind of an interesting way to see it now, you know, to view it in a totally different light.
Yeah, it's kind of offensive. I don't like it when voluntary exchanges get demonized. Because the only other option is coercion and violence. And that means you're, by proxy or whatever you want to call it, kind of glorifying coercion, even though the book doesn't necessarily glorify. I mean, there's threats, like you said, but, I mean, these are, like, what, dreams he's having from, like, ghosts or whatever. I mean, it's not like a real human is threatening him with whatever. But, yeah, there are threats happening, whether they're real or not. Who can say? I guess they're real enough for the story. But, yeah, it demonizing voluntarism and glorifying coercion is always going to be disgusting to me now. Maybe it wasn't so much back when I was a lefty liberal guy, but now it's very gross. Because I see the world through these voluntary glasses now. And it's always going to taint my appreciation for a piece of artwork like this.
Yeah, and Dickens was certainly doing it in a for political reasons, you know. It was a propaganda piece. And in the wiki, it says that he was inspired by the parliamentary reports exposing the effects of the Industrial Revolution on poor children. And, of course, this was a, you know, very cherry-picked commission. I think Murray talks about it in one of his lectures. Ralph Rako certainly does in his talks on the Industrial Revolution. And in Tom Wood's Liberty Classroom, you can learn about this stuff as well. ReadRothbard.com/Liberty Classroom, where they take anecdotal evidence and compile it all together and say, look how evil and terrible industry is, these factories, these terrible conditions. And Dickens was going to write a pamphlet about these conditions, but then he realized that, you know, no one reads this crap anyway. So he says, quote, "You will certainly feel that a sledgehammer has come down with 20 times the force, nay, 20,000 times the force I could exert by following out my first idea, which is writing a political pamphlet versus creating this story, A Christmas Carol."
Indeed. And the child labor is never a popular thing. It's really not. The idea of a childhood, a happy childhood, working in a factory, probably not. It's more of like, you know, the child should be educated, happy, be able to play and whatnot. But it's, that wasn't the choice. The choice wasn't the child gets to either work in a factory or gets to go around and play and learn and whatnot. It's work in a factory or starve. So I mean, unless you got a situation where you have a father or a parent or whatever is like forcing the child to work, but I don't know if that's necessarily the case all the time. You know, the family needed a certain amount of food to survive, and you got that labor. It's not the most attractive thing in the world, but it's better than dying. It's actually more noble because you got somebody who's like, no, I'm not going to die. I will work. I want to survive. I'm a survivor. That's a very powerful thing. That's a triumph of the human spirit.
You can't compare things to the ideal. You have to compare them to the alternative. Like, what would it have been had they not done this? You know, what was it? What were conditions like before? And, you know, clearly you can even just look back through historical population charts, and I'll post a link below where it shows some of this stuff, where population explodes and extreme poverty diminishes greatly, all due to this exponential growth in agriculture and industrial production, i.e. capitalism.
I.e. Yeah, it'd be interesting. The incentives to create technology just aren't there in a communistic world. So it'd be interesting to see where we would be at technologically under that kind of a system.
Yeah, I think we'd be pretty much wherever level of technology was present at the time of that switchover, and then you'd see a devolution from there. I think you would truly see the Idiocracy, where, you know, we were questioning how they had such advanced surveillance in that movie. But, you know, once everyone becomes dumb or not entrepreneurial, I think you'd lose the even maintenance of whatever existing systems there were, and you'd go back in time in sort of like a regression to more primitive methods.
Indeed. Indeed, because, yeah, nothing lasts forever.
Yeah. So, hey, speaking of not lasting forever, this show is probably going to start winding down. It is a special, so we don't really stick to any particular time frame, not that we ever have in the past anyway. And I was a little bit jumping the gun on our friend Anthony being able to join us. He did experience additional technical difficulties, so he is not going to be able to make it on this time, but he promises to make it up to us, so perhaps we will have him on in a future episode. We do recommend checking out his blog. It's seeingnotseen.blogspot.co.uk, and he also is on the Scottish Liberty podcast, which is on SoundCloud and I believe also on YouTube. They are very fun to listen to. They've got Scottish accents, and I think he says that because he's Scottish, every other word is pretty much a swear word. So he'd fit right in with us here at the Reed Rothbard podcast.
That's right. Even though we haven't been really swearing a whole lot lately, we need to get back on it. But, you know, they're sentence enhancers is what they are. So
it's for emphasis, fucking emphasis.
That's right.
And it's great when my three-year-old, right before, we did Christmas presents yesterday because we're going to go see family. And my three-year-old says, Merry fucking Christmas.
Nice.
So we had to tell her,
yeah,
like,
your daughter.
That's not exactly how you're supposed to be saying that. You know, and on the Reed Rothbard podcast, it's Merry Christmas, you know. And Anthony, when we were Facebooking, he's like, I said Merry Christmas to him, and he says, and a Happy New Year, like Hans Hermann Hoppe. So wish I had thought of that. So I give Anthony credit on that one. So Merry Christmas and Happy New Year, everybody.
Indeed, indeed.
So, yeah, let's wind this one down. I know you're not feeling great. You need to hit the recovery room so that you can make it down to Seattle. So thank you for being a trooper and joining me on this sort of special that didn't quite go according to plan, but I still think we had some interesting things to say, especially about Christmas Carol and the Disneyfication, at least of the version I saw. And, you know, everyone, happy holidays. We really do appreciate you. It's been a great year. And we intend to continue to do the podcast, develop the site, have additional content, and a whole bunch of other goodies coming your way in 2017.
Yeah, sorry I wasn't exactly on point today. I wasn't my normal, energetic, angry, emotional self. But I think everyone's been where I'm at right now. I can understand. Sometimes, you know, you're having a good time and you don't want the good time to stop. And before you know it, it's 3 in the morning and you got a podcast to do in a few hours. And, you know, you're probably not going to be at your best. But you do it anyway because you love it. So thanks for listening and thanks for putting up with me.
Yeah, and I think you said you only had 3 beers, and that's a function of you just not drinking out when you're out in the hill country there.
Yeah, I just don't have alcohol, and there's really, you know, you're just out there by yourself. There's not exactly party time excellent all the time. So, yeah, your tolerance just disappears, or at least mine does. Although there are some famous drinkers out in them bar hills, let me tell you. There are guys that will put back, you know, 30 beers a night. But, you know, those people, I think, don't necessarily live that long because you're at that point, you're just attacking your liver with a machine gun.
Yeah, not Andre the Giant style, just normal hill folk drinking that much, huh?
Yeah, not like a 500-pound guy. We're talking like a 150-pound guy just chugging it. So, yeah, probably not the best. Even with, thanks for putting up with me. I promise next time I will be back on it. Even though I make all kinds of promises on this podcast and rarely fulfill them, I'm probably not going to be hungover the next time. No promise.
All right, looking forward to that. And yeah, we are full of making promises and breaking promises. We're heartbreakers on the Reed Rothbard podcast.
That's right.
Well, thank you, folks, for joining us. And again, Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. And we will sign off. Good night, folks.
Take care, everybody.
Chipmunks. CHIPMUNK. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. do 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 do